Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast all across this great land, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system. Streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, on cable systems in 29 states, on CRN Digital, and, of course, at AirAmericaRadio.com. You can also pick up our web stream. Welcome to our program. It's Friday, the first hour of our program, when we, for several years now, have been so pleased to have with us Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives, now running as an independent for the United States Senate, representing the great state of Vermont. And Congressman Sanders, welcome. Hey, Bernie.
How are you?
I am absolutely great today. It's actually, I'm a little... I'm running on about 4 hours sleep because last night I moderated a debate between the governor and the two challenges to the governor, to a sitting governor here, for the Democratic primary in Oregon. And so I was up late, and I get up at 3 a.m. to do my radio show. So
don't fall asleep.
Yeah, there you go.
But wait till the next hour.
Well, that's the benefit of having you in this first hour, is that you will wake me up. I know that. So yesterday we learned, Bernie, that that guy that George W. Bush has been looking for, the leaker, you'll recall, he said...
I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official... Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Apparently, that guy he's been looking for the last 2 years.
We found him.
It's him!
All right. There you go.
So what's your take on all this?
You know, it's just another outrage about the abuse of power of this administration, which is rapidly, I think, being understood by the American people as being the most reactionary, incompetent, administration, certainly in the modern history of America, maybe in our entire country, and an administration which really cares very little about the basic constitutional rights which have governed our nation for so very long. In this particular case, what they have done is they had Scooter Libby go to Judith Miller and release classified information, which, by the way, they did not fully even release to her, backing up their position on the Iraq war, in this case dealing with the aluminum tubes, trying to justify why they went into war. You know, it's just another example of how these guys operate and that the law is supposed to apply to everybody except to them. So, A, they did not fully declassify this, obviously. They selectively declassified it. And B, when they declassified it to her, they only gave her half of the story. They forgot to mention that there were people in the intelligence community who had different opinions about the use of those aluminum tubes and that they were not related to a nuclear program in Iraq.
Yeah. And of course, it ends up in the New York Times then.
Right. So on and it goes, and it brings us back to the all-important question of why we went to war in the first place. And over again, and what this particular leak was about, is that we hear from the Bush administration that the intelligence community told them that, A, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, B, they were prepared to act aggressively and proactively against the United States, C, among other things, there was a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda, that Iraq was working with al-Qaeda to provide them with weapons of mass destruction, that, D, there was evidence about a nuclear program, i.e. these aluminum tubes, or getting the uranium from Niger, and on it goes. And every other day, what you're seeing is very knowledgeable people coming forward who say, no, that wasn't true. That's not what we told the president. No, he had two points of view. No, not everybody told him this, but, and, you know, the evidence is becoming, I think, stronger and stronger that the president was not telling the truth. as to why we went into this terrible war, which has now cost us 2,300 lives and 17,000 wounded, $300 billion in massive destruction in Iraq. So I think where we're at right now, Tom, is there is an absolute and crying need. And my colleague, Henry Waxman, who is the ranking member on the Government Reform Committee, of which I sit, which is the Oversight Committee in the House of Representatives, Henry has just sent the president a letter demanding questions. But the real issue is we need serious hearings in the House, understanding what the president knew and when he knew it.
But the bottom line, Congressman Bernie Sanders, is that that won't happen as long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate.
That's exactly, I suspect 99-1 that is exactly the case. I'm afraid, and you know, and I made this point on the show before, Tom, it's not a sexy issue. But the truth is that one of the most important aspects of our government is the division of powers that we have, right? We learned that in third grade. You know, you got a judiciary, you got a president, you got a Congress, and each one has their responsibilities. What has happened, I think, in an unprecedented manner with this White House and this Congress is what Congress has said, we're not going to act as an independent branch of government. We're going to act as a rubber stamp for the White House. Mr. President, you do what you want to do. We'll say, okay. And lately, as Bush's poll numbers have gone down, that's changed a little bit. But by and large, that has been the conduct of this Congress and this congressional leadership. I sit, as I said, on this Government Reform Committee, and I can remember when Bill Clinton was president. And forget Monica Lewinsky. On every other week, there was a hearing about virtually, you know, everything that Clinton did.
He fired a travel agent. He gets investigated.
Oh, Travelgate. That went on and on and on. And there was it was too ludicrous to even mention all of the hearings that occurred. They never stopped. Now, you just think about all of the things. Think about the fact that millions and millions of people, including, you know, the parents of our soldiers themselves, people, you know, related to those who died in Iraq, what answers the questions? Now, I don't think you convict the president until you have these questions. I want to hear his point of view. I want to know what he believes, what Karl Rove believes, what these guys believe, what Dick Cheney believes. But those questions have got to be asked, Mr. President. There are folks who are telling us that you were very public and private in your cabinet about wanting to invade Iraq before 9/11. Is that true? Did you use 9/11 as an excuse to invade Iraq? Why did you tell us there was a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq when you had intelligence agencies telling you that information that you were receiving was unreliable? You know, when you why did you talk or have Colin Powell talk about aluminum tubes being used as a nuclear part of a nuclear program when people were saying in the intelligence agencies that may not be the case? Why did you cherry-pick the information? I want to hear what the president has to say. But I think the American people are entitled to hear answers to those questions.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the larger issue of what's the future and fate of our economy. We saw just in this last week now gold hitting $600 an ounce, oil going to $67 and change a barrel, people talking about the possibility of $3 average, maybe as much as $4 a gallon.
Tom, it is. I'm glad you're saying on that issue because it's important. You know, a lot of activists, you know, are into Iraq and terribly important issue. But, you know, a lot of people back home almost don't have the time to worry about Iraq because they're busy trying to figure out how they're going to survive economically. And just if you look at the economy, what you find is that the record of the Bush administration, the Republicans here in Congress, and I want everybody to remember, they control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House. This has been just a terrible record for the middle class of our country. Now, I admit, I'm the first to admit that if you're a millionaire and a billionaire, hey, you're doing really good. There have been, as you know, Tom, a huge increase in the number of billionaires in America, in the number of millionaires. But if you're in the middle class, what's probably happened is you're part of that group with real household income has declined 5 years in a row. Under this president, we have seen the worst private sector job creation record since the Great Depression. We have lost almost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. Most of the new jobs that are being created a low wage with minimal benefits. I was just on the floor of the House yesterday dealing with this terrible pension crisis all over this country. Corporations are saying to their older workers, well, thank you for working for us for 30 years. Too bad we have to cut the pensions that we promised you by 30 or 40 or 50%. You got an administration that has run up huge deficits, national debt, now over $8 trillion, $28,000 every man, woman, and child. And you know what they want to do? They want to give out more tax breaks to the richest people in this country. And then you say, gee, Mr. President, what about the minimum wage? $5.15 an hour. Do you expect anybody to raise a family, live on $5.15 an hour? Oh, we can't deal with that. We're not going to raise the minimum wage. So, you know, this administration is certainly the worst in modern history. They're going to rank at the very bottom, in my view, in American history.
Yeah, particularly with regard to the economy. We're speaking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, Congressman Sanders, pleased to take your calls. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. 440-THOM. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been eliminated, repositioned, been told my career is in transition, right-sized, reshaped, reduced, released, and every time, my pay's decreased. So I asked the big shot, why can't we raise the pitiful, paltry minimum wage? Come on, he said, now use your head. More folks will lose their jobs, he said. I work hard, my raise helps the nation, but a raise for you only causes inflation. Union PACs want to buy the election, but corporate PACs promote free expression. Folks on welfare are parasites, but corporate welfare makes the economy bright. A job is good. A job is fine. But layoffs are good for the bottom line. Yeah. Well, that just about covers it. I guess it's time to try something else. Maybe I could work for myself. If I get lazy or sick or tired, by God, I tell myself I'll be fired. That's smart.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. I encourage you to check out this website. Bernie's got a fabulous website there, www.bernie.org. Our telephone number, toll-free, all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hi. You know, Congressman Sanders, we know that statistics out of various departments, whether it's Home Security or the Pentagon, you name it, are notoriously inaccurate, inept. Yet when the Labor Department comes out with these unemployment figures, we all think, oh, they got to be right, accurate. Oh, sure. I maintain that they are as bogus as mountains around Miami. A guy calls up on C-SPAN this morning. He's in upstate New York. He says, you know, no, there's no jobs up here. People are leaving.
Yep.
I think, and I don't hear the Democrats, whether senators or congressmen, you know, saying that these figures are hyped. I mean, it is not below the Bush administration, you know, to have people create favorable statistics. We know that they've paid journalists to write favorable stories.
Let me just jump in and tell you this. There has been a lot of discussion, not just on the Bush, or from way back, about the meaning, how meaningful the unemployment statistics are for a couple of reasons. Number one, you get a job, you want to work full-time, you're working part-time, right? Now, guess what? You're employed. You got a PhD and you're driving a taxi cab. You are employed. You are living in a high unemployment area and you've given up looking for work. You just don't go out anymore. You're not a statistic anymore. So there are a lot of reasons why the official unemployment statistics underestimate the real depth of unemployment. You're working. So I think you're right on that point. I think that has been the case for many, many years, but I think some economists will tell you that real unemployment is much higher than the official statistics indicate. Second of all, what the unemployment statistics don't talk about is the quality of the jobs. If you had a job making $50,000 a year with good benefits and you lost that and you're working at McDonald's and you're making $20,000 a year, you know what? no change in the official statistics. So I think your point is well taken that we need better information about the state of the economy, what's happening to average people and working people than we have right now.
Thank you, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Ken in Lexington, Kentucky, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. I was told by your call screener that apparently my connection is not too good. So I'll make my question brief and get off, and you can answer it while I'll get off the air. Just curiosity. Supposedly, you know, once we entered Iraq, all this oil and all this stuff was supposed to pay for the war. My question is, where is all this oil? Because it's obviously not paying for the war, and our prices are through the roof. So where is the oil from Iraq?
I don't have that information on oil production in Iraq in front of me right now. My understanding is, Tom, you correct me if I'm wrong here, that oil production is now lower than it was.
That's right.
Before the war.
Yeah, it's down by, as I recall, 500,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has dropped. and Wolfowitz, it was Wolfowitz who told us that oil in Iraq would pay for the war.
Well, and I'm not quite so sure how the people of Iraq feel about that either.
Yeah, not quite. We're not quite there. Gene in Kenmore, Washington. Hey, Gene, we have just 1 minute before we've got to take a break.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. Bernie, I'm sure you're familiar with Ron Paul, the representative from
Texas. Yes, I know
Texas.
Ron pretty well.
Yes, I heard him on Special Orders the other night talking about the threat of the administration taking military action against Iran, and it was really, really frightening to hear that. And I'm just wondering how you can work with Ron and others like him and the Democrats to put a stop to that.
Well, let me say this, Gene, about Ron Paul. Ron Paul is on almost every issue. His views are very different than mine. But Ron Paul is a man of integrity and honesty who stands up and says what he believes. And I think in many ways he's one of the few very honest conservatives here who oppose the war in Iraq and is quite right in issuing warnings about what these guys in the White House might do in Iran. And I certainly look forward to working with Ron on that issue to make sure that we do not go into another war, this time a war against Iran.
Yeah, and we should note Ron Paul's a Republican as well.
A very conservative Republican.
There you go. 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There are people in this country who work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time. Work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us for this hour, as he is every Friday. Our number 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. There's also a blog. Click on the blog message area if you want to drop into that spot. And, of course, if you want to visit Bernie's website, and I strongly encourage you to, it's a great news source, all kinds of information about, in general, you know, what's happening in the news, progressive politics, and Congressman Bernie Sanders, of course, in his run for the Senate, Bernie.org, that website. 1-866-440-8466. Glenn in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Glenn, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Congressman Sanders. I have two quick questions for you. One, the first question is, what do you think the immediate result of dissolving the WTO and our free trade agreements would be? And two, do you think that the Democrats will ever be able to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act? That's it. Thank you.
Good. Glenn asks very good questions. I can only tell you, Glenn, that our current trade policies, whether it's NAFTA, PNTR with China, or the WTO, are very clearly not working for the middle class and working families of our country. They are working for the CEOs of large multinational corporations who are making billions by throwing American workers out on the street and moving to China and other low-wage countries. The problem, by the way, is not just in blue-collar manufacturing jobs. This problem is spilling over big time to white-collar information technology jobs. There are studies out there that suggest that we may be at the cusp of hemorrhaging millions and millions of good-paying middle-class white-collar jobs as well. So my own thought is that what we need to do is say, wait a second, trade is a good thing. But like any trade agreement that any individual makes, the trade agreement has got to be good for both sides and not just for one side. When you have a $725 billion trade deficit, a $200-plus billion trade deficit with China, which is growing, when increasingly it is harder and harder to find a product manufactured in the United States, when China is exploding with brand-new technology, building some of the most sophisticated products in the world, we have got a problem. So my view is we need to fundamentally rethink our trade policies. I have introduced legislation which would terminate permanent normal trade relations with China, and I think that is the direction that we have got to go. Can you snap your fingers and make it happen? No. But we do really have to figure out how we create decent-paying jobs in America, how we get these large corporations to start investing here rather than in countries where people are paid 30 or 40 cents an hour. In terms of labor law in general, you again ask a good question. Will the Democrats repeal Taft-Hartley? I doubt it. Do we need, however, to take a hard look at labor law right now to make sure, for example, one of many examples, is that working people in this country who want to join a union have a fair opportunity to do so? Increasingly, what we're seeing is a National Labor Relations Board, which is stacked against workers, which is in favor of employers, which is making it harder and harder for workers to form unions. And I think we need significant changes in our labor law so that any worker in America who wants to exercise his or her constitutional right to form a union should be able to do so. So we need fundamental changes in labor law, because without strong unions, working people are not going to have the protections that they need to negotiate decent contracts and to protect their jobs. So great. That's my view.
Well said, and thanks for that call, and thanks for listening to WPTT in Pittsburgh. Jason in Wyoming, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Jason.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. And a couple of months ago, you met my dad when you were at a function in Grand Rapids.
I did.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just want to let you know that a couple of weeks ago, or maybe a month or so ago, he got a letter from his former employer, a local furniture manufacturer, who's no longer operating in the area. And they just were letting all the retirees know that their retirement has been reconfigured.
Yep.
And that up to a certain year's point, he's made it, fortunately, to that point. But if there are people that are under a certain point of years within their retirement, then they would not be receiving their full benefit.
Right. Jason, that is precisely what's happening all over the country. As I understand it, what Jason is talking about is when people retire, they receive certain benefits. What a lot of companies are now doing are freezing the benefits. They're not putting anything more into it. So as health care costs go up, for example, or other costs go up, it is the retirees themselves who are going to have to pick up a larger and larger share of those benefits. This is a very, very serious problem, and a lot of major corporations are reneging on the retiree benefits that they promised their workers. And this is tied right in to the other fact that many of these large corporations are now converting their defined pension benefit plans to cash balance plans or other plans, which have the impact of substantially lowering the pensions that long-time and older workers are receiving. There was just a good vote, by the way, yesterday on the floor of the House, where a number of Republicans joined virtually all of the Democrats and myself, which said that you can't do that. That if you make a retirement program, defined pension program, you cannot convert it to a cash balance program without a worker saying, "Yeah, I'll take that," which of course they won't.
Mm. Good. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont, listening on WVAA in Burlington. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, Congressman Sanders.
Hi.
First up, I want to say, Congressman Sanders, you've done a wonderful job here in Vermont representing the people. And I want people out there to know what it feels like when they're very, very cynical to actually get a congressman who is not just dealing with special interests and things like that. I may not always agree with you all the time, but I don't expect that. But you do represent the people here.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
And I wanted to ask you a question. And
I should tell everybody that Grand Isle is a beautiful, beautiful town.
Well, actually, I live in South Hero.
Oh, South Hero is also.
Yeah, I'm the mailman in South Hero.
That's great.
All right. And this is a bit local politics, but as everybody knows, you're running for Senate.
Yep.
One thing I'm worried about, and I know you won't say this on the air, but I mean, I think you are going to become senator. Your numbers are like far up above Rich Tyrant there. And what I'm worried about is the congressional seat that you're giving up here in the state. It looks like it very, very well may be won by Rainville, the Republican candidate. And I think at this time, I mean, it's very important that we take back Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And while it'd be great to see you as a senator, I would love to see that. How are you looking at that?
Well, this is how I'm looking at it. Obviously, I am running for the Senate. We're running hard. And what Jeff is talking about to those 98% of the people who are listening who are not from Vermont is I'm running against one of the wealthiest people in the state who's going to spend five times as much money as any candidate has ever spent in Vermont history. But I think we're going to win. And we're working really hard. And, Jeff, I appreciate your support. There is obviously, with me running for the Senate, the Vermont House seat is up for grabs. What polls seem to indicate is that's going to be a very, very tight race. And what I have said is that I hope very much that Peter Welch, who is the Democratic candidate, will win that election, because I think it is extremely important that Democrats take back the House, and this may come down to a couple of seats, just a couple of seats. And what everybody must know, no matter what state you're from, the most important vote that a member of the House or the Senate casts is not their views on health care or the environment or the war in Iraq. It is who controls the body, who sets the agenda, who is going to be the leadership, because the leadership has virtually all of the power in setting the priorities that the Congress deals with, and that is especially true in the House. And I would hope very much that Vermont's next representative to the United States Congress is not going to be part of a right-wing, you know, will not be casting a vote supporting right-wing leadership of the House of Representatives, and that's why I'm supporting Peter Welch.
Yeah, and Peter Welch is a good guy. He was a state. He wasn't he the Speaker in the State Senate?
When I was he was the President of the. He is
the President.
Right
now. Yeah, the President of the Senate. Yeah, he's a very good guy. Gary in Coos Bay, Oregon, listening on KBVR. Hey, Gary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to say something about illegal immigration, and I think if we had been a better neighbor, we wouldn't have this problem. And that I also think it's a smokescreen for getting away from Iraq and that sort of thing. But I think it is the IMF and World Bank and the Reagan policies that have come home to roost in the third world, and they are on our doorstep, and we're going to have to deal with it.
Well, let me just say this, Gary. I was just talking to somebody about it the other day. I can remember very clearly when we were debating NAFTA, which I strongly opposed. One of the arguments in favor of NAFTA is that NAFTA is going to lift the standard of living of the people in Mexico. It's going to provide decent paying jobs for the people in Mexico. And the impact of that will be that there'll be less illegal immigration. Well, needless to say, that has not been the case. And interestingly enough, when you talk about Latin America and our neighbors to the south, what you're finding is in country after country after country, people are exercising their vote to say no to this neoliberal economic policies of the IMF and the World Bank.
Yeah, well said. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org is website. I encourage you to check it out. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Stick around, my friends.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now the thing that I call living is just been satisfied with knowing I got no one left to blame. Every highway I got to see you, my old flame. Every highway you seen better days. A morning after blues, I head down to my shoes.
And welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour, 10 minutes, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie, our regular Friday segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, Bernie.org, his website. Tim in Saginaw, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Mr. Hartman, Congressman Sanders, appreciate you taking my call. My call is concerning the National Air Traffic Controller Association contract with the FAA and how it's come to impasse. As you well know, that means it has 60 days in Congress. I'm just interested to see what your thoughts and comments are concerning that.
This is the National Traffic Controllers.
Correct, National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
Right, I know a little bit about that. And what I know is that we need traffic controllers who are well-paid, well-trained, who are proud of their careers and feel good about their jobs. And I know negotiations are not going well right now, and we will do what we can to support these controllers. I mean, these guys, you know, when we're up in the air and millions of Americans fly every year, we want to make sure that we have the best trained people making sure that, planes are landing safely and are flying safely. And these guys do a tremendous job. Our record of air safety is a very, very good one up in the air. And these people need support, and we will do what we can to make sure that they get a good contract.
Thanks for that call. Barb in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Congressman Sanders. I had a two-part question. Yesterday I read that Tom DeLay was going to be eligible for a $67,000 a year and change pension plus medical coverage once he retires, gets out of Congress this year. And I was wondering, one, is that true? And number two, it seems very immoral to me when those are two of the biggest issues facing average Americans, health care and pension reform, that if he is convicted, if there's anything we can do to stop it.
I read the same article, and I honestly don't know the answer. I just don't know. It may well be true. And in terms of pensions, though, what I can tell you, and again, this debate took place yesterday, there is a huge crisis, and if Congress does not stand up, and this is the point that I made on the floor of the House, if Congress acquiesces and allows millions of American workers to lose their pensions, they should do the same thing with their own pensions. We have a defined pension benefit plan here, and if that's good enough for us and we don't want to move to another type of pension which has much less in value, then I think we have got to defend every American worker who's in the same position.
Thanks, Bernie. And thanks, Barb, for listening on Talk 1090 there in Seattle. Alan in Waynesville, North Carolina, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Alan.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. Bernie, I'm a big fan of yours. I used to live in New Hampshire right next door, and I can't say enough about how great you are helping out. I just wanted to say that it seems to me when we got involved in Iraq that President Bush said we were only going to be there a few months. Is my memory faulty?
I don't know if Bush or Cheney did, and a lot of these guys were saying it was going to be, what was it, a walk in the park? What was the expression?
Cakewalk.
Cakewalk.
Yeah.
Was that what they walked?
Yeah. Something like that.
And this speaks to their absolute lack of preparation for this war, their lack of understanding about the culture of the country, their lack of preparation in terms of the kind of armor and equipment that our troops needed over there, the fact that they disbanded Saddam's army and on. I think very few people will deny today that they were totally unprepared for what has happened, and our troops and the American people are paying the price for that.
I think Alan's question ultimately was, can Congress get us out of Iraq?
Well, I certainly hope so. My own view is that the evidence is pretty clear that the Iraqi people themselves believe in pretty large numbers that our presence there is only making a bad situation worse. I think we should listen to them. I think we should bring our troops home as soon as possible. And by that, I think, you know, majority of our troops could be out in 6 months and virtually all of them in a year.
James, let us hope so. James in Bakersfield, California.
Hello, Bernie. Hello, Tom.
Hi, James.
Hey, James.
Hey, listen, Bernie, thank you. I really appreciate you every Friday coming out here and telling people how it is. I've got two concerns, Bernie, with the guest labor program that's floating around out there. I'm an over-the-road truck driver, Bernie, and I have to say that my wages, I'm just not very worthwhile, okay? And because of that, we are 20,000 drivers short, this industry is. So if we bring in guest laborers to fill those positions, Bernie, it'll be hopeless that we'll ever see worthwhile wages.
Yep.
My second concern is that somebody like Halliburton or another company who has the resources can form a huge, huge labor contract labor division and then start soliciting Delphi, Ford, Chevrolet to replace the existing labor with dirt cheap labor, Bernie.
James, I agree with your concerns. And this whole immigration issue is a very difficult and complicated issue, but what everybody should be mindful is that some of the biggest supporters of this guest labor program are large corporations and employers who want to do, as I think James is indicating, use those folks for cheap labor and to depress wages in the United States. So I think that is a very legitimate concern.
Alice in Humboldt County, we have just a few seconds left, Alice.
Okay.
But you're on the air.
Okay.
Oh, Alice, I'm sorry. The few seconds was less than I thought it was. We'll come back to this next week. Thank you very much. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, if you can stick around, I have to speak with you off air for just a second, if you don't mind. This is the Tom Hartman radio program. You're smack dab in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Our Brunch with Bernie segment will be back next week. Coming up on the program, we're going to be having a conversation, shall we say, with Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute. Is it okay with him if we end up with one big company running all of America? 57 minutes past the hour.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Alice in Humboldt County was kind enough to hold over the break. Alice,
okay.
I'm sorry, I ran out of time there during that last segment, but what's up?
Can I give you a message for Bernie?
Certainly.
Okay. Bernie, for a long time now, I have been believing that once you come to really believe that the Republicans are in power because of riggable voting machines, only you can get there. Wait a minute. Will you, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Will you be the person who will seriously do something about it? So how do we get you there?
Mm-hmm. Bernie, I can't, you know, I wouldn't deign to speak for Bernie, but I can tell you in the past, Alice, when you've raised this issue with him on this radio program, he's pointed out that he strongly supports Rush Holt's legislation to, at the very least, make these voting machines, generate paper trails and or a paper ballot, actually, and, you know, random audits and all those sorts of things. And he also, I think, shares my philosophical perspective that it's crazy that we have private corporations handling our votes. Again, I'm not speaking for him, and these are my words, not his, but... But you know that he's very, very strong on this issue. So,
That's what we need.
Yeah, I agree.
A good fight on the voting machines because it depends on our election.
I agree, Alice. I agree, and that's why I encourage people to go to Bernie.org and and support Bernie. So thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. Also, there's more information on that at blackboxvoting.org. We had Bev Harris on yesterday talking about the issue. So it's fascinating stuff. By the way, George W. Bush, I mean, the big news, of course, what everybody's talking about, this is going to be on all the weekend shows and all this kind of thing. It turns out, way back when George W. Bush was saying...
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Who was the secret leaker? Who was the traitor in the White House? And then, you know, he actually got pretty specific about it. I mean, this back on October 7th of last year, George W. Bush.
This is a town of where a lot of people leak. And I've constantly expressed my displeasure with leaks, particularly leaks of classified information. And I want to know. I want to know the truth. I want to see to it that the truth prevails.
He wants to see to it that the truth prevails. And apparently the truth is coming out. And, well, anyhow, here's George W. Bush back on October 28th of last year.
I'd like to know if somebody in my White House did leak sensitive information. As you know, I've been outspoken on leaks. Whether they happen in the White House or happen in the administration or happen on Capitol Hill, they can be very damaging. And so this investigation is ongoing and by professionals who do this for a living, and I hope they would like to know.
Yeah. Yes. Like to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now we know. You know, the leaker that George W. Bush has been looking for is George W. Bush. And, of course, his comments on the topic yesterday, or not his comments yesterday, his comments on this topic, this from a few months ago, is speaking about, in this case, he was talking about how dare somebody leak to the New York Times. And, by the way, they did it a year ago, and the New York Times sat on the story for a year so that it wouldn't interfere with the presidential election, shall we say, that George W. Bush was illegally wiretapping people. George W. Bush, a couple months back.
There's a process that goes on inside the Justice Department, and I presume about leaks. I presume that process is moving forward. My personal opinion is, it was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in a time of war. The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy. You got to understand, and I hope the American people understand, there's still an enemy that would like to strike the United States of America, and they're very dangerous.
Well, if that's the case, sir, respectfully, why would you authorize the leaking of Valerie Plame Wilson's name and thus bring down Brewster Jennings, the CIA front company that was out there in the world, saying that, hey, we're available. If you're a terrorist and you want to buy some weapons, come knock on our door. We'll do this stuff. We've figured out a way to do it under the table. We'll sell you Stinger missiles. We'll sell you nuclear parts. And flushing out of the woodwork terrorists from all over the world, how many Brewster Jennings agents, employees around the world working for Valerie Plame were murdered after her name was made public? We don't know. The Bush administration won't tell us. It's classified. How badly was our intelligence compromised because Valerie Plame's name was leaked? Because this whole thing was, you know, blew up like the Bush administration won't tell us. That's classic. The little people don't need to know. The Bush administration, he's not one of the Bushies. They're not part of the little people. They don't pay taxes. They don't have to live by the rules. They just kind of make it up as they go along. And it's incredible that out of one side of his mouth, he's saying to Cheney and Scooter Libby, hey, psst, go ahead, you know, leak the information. And out of the other side of his mouth, he's saying things like,
but it is a shameful act by somebody who has got secrets of the United States government and feels like they need to disclose them publicly.
Yeah, shameful acts. Shameful acts. And in the meantime, Fox News cleaning up their own newscast. I mean, here's Brit Hume on Fox News, and there's a crawl going across the bottom of the screen that talks about how President Bush authorized the leak of sensitive information, and they're like, "Hey, wait a minute! We don't want our viewers to see that. We don't want them to know that that's the news report."
That's why I think when you say use the word going off half-cocked, I think people may go off half-cocked when they read that headline. President Bush authorized the leak of sensitive
information. Yeah, I wish we could get it off our screen. It's not clear to me that's what he's saying at all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us here today.
I agree with you.
Clearing up the situation, as always. Thanks, Brett. Good seeing you.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Good seeing you. Thanks, Brett, for helping us clean up our act here at Fox News and make sure that we're catapulting the propaganda correctly. Brit Hume on CNN says, well, you know, if Bush leaked the information, then it was declassified, and therefore it wasn't illegal, nothing wrong with it, so what's the big deal?
Before we go charging off after the idea that the president or vice president leaked something, we ought to figure out whether it was an authorized or an unauthorized leak. And so far as I understand it, and I asked the vice president about this back in February, both he and the president have the legal authority under an executive order signed by the president to make public classified information. So that takes the unauthorized out of it.
So Bush signs an executive order that gives him and Cheney the legal authority to simply say, okay, this is declassified. And then he can selectively declassify anything he wants and feed it via Scooter Libby to a New York Times reporter so that they can get their spin out there. And they only get out the partial spin. This particular national intelligence estimate, NIE, that was leaked was really contained two stories. One was that there were some people who thought that the aluminum tubes that were going to Iraq might be used for a centrifuge, which could be used to separate out the heavier fractions of uranium from the lighter fractions so that they could concentrate the heavier fractions, and this is the stuff that you use to make a nuclear bomb out of. You know, you put it in the tube and you spin it around, a centrifuge, and the heavy stuff settles to the bottom. But there was another faction within the military that was saying these tubes are the wrong diameter. They're the wrong thickness and the wrong diameter, but they are the exact perfect diameter to be used as the fuel lines for rocket motors. They carry the fuel from the rocket, you know, to a rocket motor. And Iraq has rockets, and they can legally have rockets as long as they have a range of less than 150 miles, as I recall. And what Saddam Hussein says these things are for is for rocket motors. And it looks like that's what they're really for. Well, that part, Scooter Libby didn't leak. So this isn't just about a leak. This is about a leak and a lie. And whether it's legal or not, I mean, that Fox News is going through all these contortions to say, well, maybe it's not illegal. It's still lying to the American people about a war that has cost us thousands of lives. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Rich and poor, lord and boor, hark to the blast of war. Tinker and tailor and millionaire, actor in triumph and priest in prayer. Comrades now in the hell out there, sweep to the fire of war. Prince and page, sod and sage, hark to the roar of war. Port professor and circus clown, chimney sweep and pop of the town, into the pot and be melted down, into the pot of war.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and by the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-1888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE. And be sure to say hi when you give him a call. Tell him Tom Hartman sent you. Welcome back to our program where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of. Like, you know, there was this incredible moment yesterday speaking about the wiretaps, and which really are part of this whole larger leak thing. We've got Bush leaking, apparently selectively leaking information to refute Joe Wilson, who was simply telling the truth about the lies that Bush was telling us to get us into war. And then you've got Bush using that exact war that he lied us into as the justification for wiretapping Americans. And then to get, you know, a whole level of weirdness even deeper, yesterday at one of his town halls, this fellow by the name of Harry Taylor gets up and speaks, and speaks out directly, you know, just confronts George W. Bush. Here he is.
You talk about freedom. I see you assert your right to tap my telephone, to arrest me and hold me without charges, to try to preclude me from breathing clean air and drinking clean water and eating safe food. If I were a woman, you'd like to restrict my opportunity to make a choice.
I'm not your favorite guy. Go ahead.
It was actually, a fairly competent response, frankly, on Bush's part there. I was surprised by his being quick on his feet like that. My guess is that he's been well rehearsed. But anyhow, he continues.
I have never felt more ashamed of nor more frightened by my leadership in Washington, including the presidency, by the Senate and
No, let her say. Let her speak.
Yeah. I feel like, despite your rhetoric, that compassion and common sense have been left far behind during your administration. And I would hope from time to time that you have the humility and the grace to be ashamed of yourself, inside yourself.
That's Harry Taylor. And then George W. Bush responds by going into a long rant about how the wiretaps that he says, you disagree with me on the wiretaps? Well, I'll tell you, the wiretaps are only to people from Al-Qaeda outside the country talking to people inside the country, or from only people inside the country talking to people from Al-Qaeda outside the country. Now, I think all of us would, you know, if somebody from Al-Qaeda is calling somebody in the United States, I think all of us would like the NSA to be listening in on that. Nobody has a problem with that, of course. But, you know, there's two problems with Bush's saying that. The first is, if that's what it's all about, he can get a warrant from a FISA court. He can do it legally. He doesn't have to do it illegally. And he's been asserting the right to do it illegally. And it's like, you know, no thank you, Mr. Bush. And secondly, at the same time that Bush is saying this, the Washington Post reports, Attorney General Alberto R. Gonzalez left open the possibility yesterday that President Bush could order warrantless wiretaps on telephone calls occurring solely within the United States, a move that would dramatically expand the reach of a controversial National Security Agency surveillance program. You get this? Adam Schiff, he's a Democrat from California, a congressman, the House Judiciary Committee. Gonzalez is testifying, and Schiff asks him if it's legal under their, you know, new interpretation or their new hallucination or whatever. I mean, there is no law that makes this legal, right? The FISA law makes it quite explicitly illegal. But he asked Gonzalez if, in his opinion, it was legal to listen in on a domestic call without supervision. Gonzalez, quote, I'm not going to rule it out, end quote. As Danny Egan notes in the Washington Post, in the past, Gonzalez and other officials refused to say whether they had the legal authority to conduct warrantless eavesdropping on domestic calls and have stressed that the NSA eavesdropping program is focused only on international communications. Now they seem to be changing their tune. Gonzalez previously testified, notes Egan, in the Senate that Bush had considered including purely domestic communications in the NSA spying program, but that the idea was rejected in part because of fears of a public outcry. He also testified at that time that the Justice Department had not fully analyzed the legal issues of such a move. So we've got a law that says if you're going to wiretap any call coming into or out of the United States, and particularly any call inside the United States, you have to get a court order from the FISA court. We set up these secret courts. They, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of these warrants have been issued. Almost never do they say no. It's been working just fine. And all of a sudden, Bush decides, I don't need no stinking laws. and they hallucinate out of fabric, out of nothing.
A terrorist surveillance program.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Seems like a brand new day. Thank you, Harry Taylor. There is a new website up, thankyouharrytaylor.org. Over 6,600 people have logged on to say thank you to Harry Taylor for speaking up and speaking out to and about George W. Bush. That's quite impressive. Quite impressive.
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Lamson, the press release from Lamson, Nick Lamson, who's going to be running again, was going to be running against Tom DeLay, now will be running against whatever Republican is going to be taking Tom DeLay's place. Sent out the following press release. Tom DeLay's campaign sent out an email asking supporters to disrupt Nick Lamson's press conference this morning. At that event, a 69-year-old woman says she was assaulted by one of the DeLay thugs who showed up to disrupt the event. The woman, Marcia Rovai of Richmond, has asked the Lamson campaign to help see if any of the television stations caught this incident on tape so she can consider filing an assault charge. Several of the women at the event complained that they were pushed and shoved by male Tom DeLay supporters. I would remind you that when you go back and you look at the video from the 2000 election, where all those, quote, locals, end quote, down in Florida were banging on the windows. You know, there were three things going on at once down there. On the one hand, you had James Baker III orchestrating an effort to stop the vote, a legal effort to stop the vote in Florida, because they were quite convinced that if all the votes in the state of Florida were counted, that Al Gore would be found to have been the winner. And, in fact, that's exactly what happened. The New York Times and Washington Post reported it a year and a half later, because it took them that long to count all the votes in Florida. But Al Gore did win the majority of the votes in Florida, and therefore the Florida election, and therefore the presidency in the year 2000. So anyway, you had James Baker III down there trying to stop that through legal action. You had John Roberts, a then unknown Washington, D.C. lawyer, corporate lawyer, $1 million a year, you know, wingtip shoe, you know, in with the Federalist Society, hotshot lawyer, down in Florida, rehearsing the lawyers that James Baker was organizing, who were going to argue before the Supreme Court that it would irreparably harm George W. Bush if the vote was allowed to continue. And that actually was the basis of Bush v. Gore. You go back and you read the case, the Bush v. Gore case, and you see that the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, indeed, George W. Bush will be irreparably harmed if the vote in the state of Florida is allowed to continue to be counted. 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. One that I suspect to this very day, Sandra Day O'Connor is ruining the day that she voted, she was part of the majority on that one. You could argue the tie-breaking vote. Of course, she's a good Republican. She's a loyal Republican, a Reagan appointee. So anyhow, that was going on. John Roberts was down there prepping attorneys, playing the role of Justice Rehnquist, because he had been a clerk for Rehnquist. He knew how Rehnquist thought. He knew how, you know, he knew the internal operations of the Supreme Court. So he was helping the Bush lawyers know how to make their arguments in front of Rehnquist, who was then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And at the same time all that's going on, there's these people banging on the windows in the room where they're counting the votes, yelling, stop the vote, stop the vote, stop the vote. And it's played on national TV as a bunch of local folks who are really upset, a bunch of Floridians who are really upset that Florida is becoming politicized, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out months later, when people looked carefully at the faces in those photos, that they were staffers from the office of Tom DeLay. There was like a half a dozen or a dozen people there who had been flown down to Florida from Washington, D.C., out of Tom DeLay's office, his staffers and his interns, and they were banging on the windows. And many of those folks, including a guy by the name of John Bolton, were very well rewarded by the Bush administration for doing what they did. And now it appears history is repeating itself. Tom DeLay's thugs out here harassing the people who show up for a rally for Nick Lampson, the Democrat who's running against him. So our alert for the day. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and just click the live chat link right up there near the top of the page there. And you can drop in and say hi to some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Jake in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Jake, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Let's remember what Mr. Bush said in regards to the Libby leak when it first became public information. Bush said, if there's a leak out of my administration, I want to know who it is, and if the person has violated law, the person will be taken care of. So Mr. Bush basically, you know, said he would fire anybody who leaked classified information that damaged our national security, and it turns out it was Mr. Bush himself who did it. So I'm just waiting for his resignation. I think the only thing we can do in regards to this illegal spying program, in regards to them screwing up on national security just to get after their political enemies, we have to give the Democrats control of the Congress because George Bush and Dick Cheney need to be impeached and removed, Tom.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Jake. This is the most corrupt administration, certainly in my memory. And as far as I can tell, I mean, looking back through the history of the United States, you know, arguably the Ulysses S. Grant administration was as corrupt, but Grant himself was not. Ulysses S. Grant was just incompetent. The Bush administration is both corrupt and incompetent, and it's a terrible combination.
Jake, absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
I would just like to say that at this point, it is really party-wide with these Republicans. Look at Tom DeLay. He was the most powerful Republican in the Congress since 1998. And what did he do with his power? He takes millions of dollars, takes free trips, golf trips to Scotland, Russia, Saipan, you name it. This guy is on the public dole, taking our money and using his public office to enrich himself and his friends. That's not what a public servant's job is. Tom DeLay needs to go to prison.
Yeah, well said. Jake, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And here's, you know, again, why did we go to war in Iraq? Some people think that
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And that's true, although actually it's been recalibrated. Now, Iran sits on top of the second largest oil reserves in the world. And we'll see. Anyhow, so some people think it's that. Others think that it's probably, since we know that the first, literally, not literally, but figuratively, the first words out of their mouth when the Bushies came into the White House in January was Iraq. You know, invade Iraq, invade Iraq. And in fact, you know, the former Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, in his book, writes about how the very first cabinet meeting they had, Bush wanted to know about how to invade Iraq. And he's like, what? I mean, this is before 9/11 and everything. It's like, what's Iraq got to do with anything? So why? Why? Well, could it have to do with politics?
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush is ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission. And I personally, that's the theory to which I subscribe, is that Bush simply did this for political purposes. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you, sir?
I am great, but I'll get better, hey. Especially when I get some sleep.
I know. You're a hope to us. You're a hope to us all. But anyway, exactly what I wanted to talk about just briefly. I remember Watergate very, very well, and I just see a tremendous similarity here in the smugness the smugness of the power. George, that's the analogy between George Bush and Richard Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
The
absolutely.
Smugness in their own power. And that's
Nixon's position.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
There you go. When the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
And I submit that's going to be his legacy. To me, that's his legacy, the smugness of his power.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
Thank you. What I'm worried about, though, Tom, and I'll let you go, and then I'll listen to you. What's your opinion? I'm worried about the certain segment of the middle class, if you will. There's a high, you know, there's that higher echelon of the middle class, financially.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
You're talking about people who are making like, you know, say $50,000 to $300,000.
Probably.
Or $50,000 to
$100,000. I'm talking like maybe $80,000 to $150,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somewhere in that area. I see a lot of them not in our camp. A lot of, and also, to be frank with you, I see some smugness in them.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you.
About.
I mean, those are the folks who, who think they got a tax break and did, you know, to
and
some extent.
And put Bush into office, a lot of them.
And we
need to change their minds and hearts if we can. The only way we can, and you're so right, the bottom line is that we need to go change it at the election booth in November. Other than that, it's our own fault.
Yeah, what those folks don't realize is that they think that Bush is working, and Gary, thank you for the call, they think that Bush is working for their interests. What they don't get is that he's really not. He's using them just like he's using the Christian conservatives and you know, all the other little interest groups that he brings in, the homophobes, I mean, all these groups, the people afraid of immigration, he's using them all too. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, they tell me still time to save my soul, they tell me. All those material things you gain by exploiting other human beings.
And this is my point. I was just wrapping it up before we hit the break there just a few minutes ago. That George W. Bush, people making, you know, $100,000, $150,000, they may think Bush is their friend. What they don't get is he's the friend of the millionaires and billionaires, the real millionaires and billionaires. Not the folks who aspire to that, because he's decreasing social and economic mobility in the United States, decreasing the ability and opportunity for people to move up in their income in the United States, moving us ever closer toward monopoly in the United States, creating a permanent ruling elite, a permanent ruling class in the United States. We are now less socially mobile in the United States than we have ever been in our history, number one. And number two, we are less socially mobile than most European countries. We are less socially mobile than Britain, which has essentially a caste system and a royal family. People are more likely to move out of the economic category in which they were born and into one that is higher than that in England than they are in the United States. And that has never been the case. George W. Bush is not about opportunity. And it's not just George W. This is not a, you know, let's pick on this guy. This is what you are seeing here is the taking apart of the social contract. That social contract that Franklin Roosevelt first articulated and that the Republicans have declared war on. The conservatives have declared war on. There are still some good Republicans out there, for example, Ron Paul. But by and large, the conservatives have declared war on this. And, you know, it's for them, it is all about taking apart the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Take apart Social Security. Take apart unemployment insurance. Take apart any sort of medical care for people. Take apart any kind of social safety net. The whole idea of a social safety net. It's not in the Constitution. It's not constitutional. I'm sorry. What's in the Constitution is that we, the people, can get together and pass laws. The Congress can decide how to spend money. And if we, the people, decide that we would like to have Social Security, that's constitutional. but not if you talk to cons. Bob in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the leak of, quote, classified, end quote, material.
Right, classified slash declassified, instantaneously declassified.
But what I think that's entirely missing the point. I watched Scott McClellan give his press conference. He had to dance around all the questions, but all the press was fixated on the word classified. It doesn't really matter, but press, commentators, even columnists are not getting the important issue, and that is national security and the Iranian nuclear issue.
That's right.
This is a national security administration. They're going to run on national security. They ran on it, and yet the information that disclosed rolled up plain and an entire network company that was tracking the distribution and acquisition of weapons of mass destruction.
By, you know, among other countries, Iran.
Iran, exactly.
Yeah.
And now, since then, since a year ago or so, Iran has become very dangerous and is very close to getting nuclear weapons.
Well, actually, they're 5 to 10 years away from it, by the best
estimates. Well, I agree. That's, but, and I think that's what Plame and her and Brewster Jennings probably would have come up with.
Yeah, and what they were doing, what they were trying to stop. No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, the media is playing right into the Republican talking points. In fact, it's almost as if Karl Rove scripted the thing, you know, saying, you know, just playing right into it that oh, well, let's talk about whether or not this was classified or unclassified, because the president did give himself, with an executive order, the authority to declassify documents. The question in my mind, or the question that I think the press should be talking about, is not was this classified or unclassified, but if Bush decided to declassify a national intelligence estimate and Scooter Libby leaked it to Judith Miller, why didn't he leak to her the second half of it? He leaked the first half that said, well, some of us think these aluminum tubes might be used for centrifuges to enrich uranium. But others of us, in fact, the majority of us in the Energy Department, which is the bomb-making part of the United States government, the majority of us in the Energy Department don't think these aluminum tubes could be used for centrifuges. We think instead that they are used for rocket motors, which is exactly what they were bought for. It's what the manufacturer designed them for. It's what they were sold to Saddam Hussein for. It's what Hussein said he was buying them for. He had the rockets to fit them out with. They were delivered to the rocket facility. It's what the IAEA said they were for. Mohammed al-Baradei, the weapons inspector from the United Nations. Why didn't Scooter Libby leak that part of the memo to Judith Miller? This is about selective leaking that is designed, intended, right, straight up, stand up right from beginning to end to deceive the American people via the press. And that's the big issue, Bob, and you just nailed it perfectly. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Dave in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, just call. I agree with both you and Tom. I think the classified and declassified issue is just a distraction.
It's a smokescreen. It's what's called a straw man argument. You set up the straw man so that you can knock him down, and it looks like you're doing battle with that straw man over there when, you know, to divert attention away from the real issue over here to the side.
I think one of the other issues, though, I can't remember, but it was from months ago. I thought there was an internal CIA investigation into the effects of releasing her identity, and that other agents could have been put in jeopardy.
Other agents may have died. That report has not been declassified and has not been released.
Right. It seems to me that even if it was legal or unclassified for him to release it, you're still talking high crimes and misdemeanors to put those people in jeopardy.
Oh, certainly by the constitutional definition. I mean, a little sexual fling in the White House extramaritally, you know, Bill Clinton's problem. You know, that's an impeachable offense. If that's an impeachable offense, and according to all the Republicans in Congress, it was. If that's an impeachable offense, then this is something worthy of, what, I don't know, put him on a rocket and shoot him to the moon or something. I mean, it's like, I am running out of hyperbole, but you get it. This is serious stuff, my friends. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. A new AP Ipsos poll just out. And the again, this is, you know, this is not about, partisan, oh boy. This is, you know, the American people are waking up, and what they're waking up to is the fact that this country is not being run by Republicans, and the Bush administration generally, Republicans specifically, is not being run in the way that most Americans want it to be run. It's just very simple. New AP Ipsos poll that shows Republicans surrendering their advantage on national security, among other things. Just 36% of the public approves of Bush's job performance, his lowest ever rating in an AP Ipsos poll. And here's what I found really the most fascinating about this AP story. Rob Fournier wrote this thing, and in my opinion, he buried the lead. This should have been the first sentence. Instead, it was the next to the last sentence, two pages into the article. Bush's approval rating is down 12 points among Republicans since a year ago. 6 in 10 Republicans, 60% of Republicans, say they disapprove of the GOP-led Congress. That's the headline in my mind. Republicans are waking up. They're saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not the party. This is not the Republican Party that I thought that we had. This is not the Republican Party that I bought into. This is not the Republican Party that I believed in. Because, you know, as a simple point in fact, there was at one time a Republican Party that Republicans were proud of, that Republicans were pleased with, that Republicans, you know, wanted to be a part of, that Americans wanted to be a part of. Dwight Eisenhower, for example. Dwight Eisenhower.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
It's amazing. Every warship launched, every bullet fired signifies in a very real sense a theft. This is a Republican president speaking in 1953, the second year of his presidency. Well, arguably the first year, the election of 52. So he's in office a year. And here is the Republican president, and a great warrior at that, saying this.
This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this.
Now, here he goes through it. This is what one modern heavy bomber costs, not in dollars, but in what those dollars would represent.
A modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is. Two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is. Two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement.
Now, can you imagine if a modern Republican even asked one of their staff members, hey, do some research for me and find out what a modern battleship would be the equivalent of in terms of domestic infrastructure? Their staffers would call up Tom DeLay and say, or Denny Hastert and say, I think we've got a traitor in our midst here. This guy can't be a Republican. I'm telling you, the people who are calling themselves Republicans, the Ken Melmans of the world, the Tom DeLays of the world, they do not reflect the traditional values of the Republican Party. There are, you know, Ron Paul perhaps does, the Republican from Texas. But the vast majority of the Republicans in Congress, not a chance. Eisenhower continues.
We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all. In any true sense, Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. This is the this used to be the Republican Party. What has happened? I mean, it's not just America has lost its way. And yeah, you know, we've also done programs on how the Democratic Party has lost its way, where we listen to Franklin Roosevelt and JFK, but the Republican Party has lost its way. In very, very serious form, the Republican Party has lost its way. And so I just have to say to the Republicans listening, remember back to the day when the slogan for a Republican candidate for president was vote for peace. When the Republican candidate for president was sounding like Dennis Kucinich.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
He's met Europe's leaders. He's got them working with us. Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time.
And what does that mean, sir?
Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world. In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad.
And now here at home, we're wiretapping our own citizens. We're doing extraordinary rendition. We're putting people in jail without warrants. This is not the Republican Party. I'm sorry.
Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us.
This, by the way, Dwight Eisenhower speaking at the 1964 Republican Convention, the one that nominated Barry Goldwater.
What each of us does, how each of us acts, has an influence on this question.
And how should we be behaving, sir?
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair. In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in a sea of wretchedness and frustration.
Can you imagine? I mean, that was a Republican president speaking at a Republican convention in 1964, and he was applauded. And if a Republican stood up and said that today, they'd have him, they'd take him out and draw and quarter him. Jennifer in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Jennifer, welcome to the program. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. That speech is so moving. I love to hear it. I never tire of it.
Dwight Eisenhower?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is just incredible, and I am so in hope that the Republican people of our nation will take their party back. This is not a Republican Party anymore. This is a party of fascists.
This is, I'd say it's even beyond that, Jennifer. I'd say it is organized crime. It is being run like the mafia.
It really is, and it's very sad because the Republican Party used to be pretty cool. But anyway, I didn't call about that. I called to say I don't know who is responsible for the implication that the president declassified the information that was leaked to Miller.
That information, the implication was put forward by Scotty McClellan.
Oh, good old Scotty. Oh,
yeah, good
Scotty,
old Scotty.
The official presidential liar.
Yeah, beam me up, Scotty.
Well, the thing is, if it was declassified, my question then is, why does it have to be leaked?
Yeah, well, exactly. And actually, I should, you know, I should qualify this. Scotty McClellan is the guy who went on the record saying this. It was Scooter Libby's lawyer speaking to Patrick Fitzgerald, and Scooter Libby speaking to Patrick Fitzgerald, who suggested that Libby had not committed a crime that he could be charged with, that is, you know, releasing declassified information, or releasing classified information, because the president told him to do it, it was therefore no longer classified. This is going to be at the core of Libby's defense.
Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, I wouldn't buy it because, like I said, if it was declassified, it didn't have to be leaked.
Yeah.
He could have just written a big old letter. He could have done anything. He could have gone on the air and announced it. It was not declassified. That is a big fat fib.
This is the equivalent of Bill Clinton saying, it depends on what the word is, it means.
Oh, this is worse.
I agree. This is far, far worse. But, I mean, this is, we're talking legal splitting of hairs here when there are actual issues. Yeah, you're right. The Clinton analogy is so far removed from this. You're absolutely right, Jennifer. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. This is something. Can you imagine Dwight Eisenhower saying, well, you know, it's we had to leak that information. No, come on. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
There you go, good old Johnny Cash. Always a fine plan, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Jeffrey Kleiman's with us. He's the editor of DVD Talk, an online magazine, DVDTalk.com, the website. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great, but it'll get better. Brokeback Mountain, I understand, is out in DVD.
Yeah, this is a pretty quick release out onto DVD. Believe it or not, it's kind of shocking, but a fair amount of controversy surrounding this release. There have been protests at Walmarts, and we've even gotten angry letters from conservatives saying, how dare you promote a film like this? And so it's just mind-blowing that a film that was nominated for Best Picture, that's been out, that won Best Director and Screenplay, has controversy on DVD.
You mean you at DVDTalk.com are getting people saying, why are you talking about Brokeback Mountain?
Believe it or not, we have received posts and letters from people saying that we're promoting liberal values by reviewing.
Heaven forbid!
By reviewing or discussing Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, so the apparently then the implicit message is that conservative values are censorship.
Or rather
that censorship is a conservative value.
You know, and the interesting thing about this is this film, I think it's enigmatic that this is a gay cowboy movie. Because the truth of the matter is that Brokeback Mountain is a story about love and a life you can't have. And, you know, it's a beautiful film, and I think, you know, it's great that it's gotten all the accolades. There's a lot of controversy of why it got shot out for Best Picture. But this is an interesting litmus of, you know, how people react to this film, you know, does tell a lot about where the perspective is, especially the people who react to it who haven't seen it.
Yeah, yeah, which is probably virtually all of the people who are reacting negatively to it.
But, I think people...
I'm assuming you have seen it.
I have. I really like this movie. I wouldn't say it was my favorite movie of 2005, but, you know, Ang Lee put together a really touching, well-shot, well-acted film that has gotten a lot of accolades, and deservedly so. I think, you know, if people are shying away from this because of the subject matter, I'd encourage them to give it a try because I think it is a fine film.
Yeah, okay. The director's cut edition of Crash is out. I was at the I'm forgetting the whole thing. It was an awards dinner in Los Angeles last weekend. Mikhail Gorbachev started the organization, and I was down there Leo DiCaprio had put some money into it. He's putting together a movie on global warming. He's done a little 10-minute web movie that's on his website at leonardodicaprio.org, based on a book I wrote, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which he credits at the end of the movie. And I was down there for the weekend. They were shooting me along with a whole bunch of other people for this new movie that he's doing. And we went to this awards dinner, and a woman who was a star in Crash was one of the people who was, like, you know, giving the awards at this thing. I don't remember her name, though, and I didn't recognize her because I hadn't seen the movie. Tell me about the movie.
Well, basically, I mean, this looks at a number of parallel and intersecting stories that happen in Los Angeles that deal with prejudice and racism. It's kind of, there's kind of like in this, the note of do the right thing, in that it brings a lot more questions than gives answers to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a good film. I was honestly surprised when it won Best, you know, Picture of the Year. It's got its problems. It's not a perfect film, but, you know, that's the way the Oscars go. The interesting thing about the director's cut is this is the second DVD release for this film. It was originally released in September of last year, and in kind of a move that we call a double dip, studios have come back and said, oh, well, it won the Best Academy Award. Here's another DVD version of it.
So this has come out twice in DVD, the second time with new features that were not on the original DVD.
Right. You get a number of behind the scenes and a lot of supporting material that kind of look at really both the making of and the kind of context of, you know, the issues of Crash in Los Angeles and how Los Angeles really is one of the main characters in this film and the conduit for a lot of the issues that the film discusses. I don't want to discount it. Crash is an enjoyable film. It's not a perfect film, but it's worth checking out on DVD.
And a New York Doll and a Mel Brooks collection.
Yeah, New York Doll.
That's an interesting mix.
Yeah, New York Doll. Here's a documentary nobody probably has heard of, but it looks at a band called the New York Dolls that were around in the 70s. They had two albums, hugely influential, and then they disappeared. And this follows Arthur Killer Kane, who was the bassist, through his high highs and low lows. It's a redemption story. It's just one of these great documentaries. If you like music or you like stories about, you know, people's life journeys, I'm a big fan of New York Doll. Definitely one to check out. And then Mel Brooks. Well, you know, people have talked about a lot of Mel Brooks because of the producers and the stage show. So
And Blazing Saddles is part of this collection. One of my favorite movies of all time. It really is.
You get eight of his films. This collection that Fox has put out, you've got Blazing Saddles, and I love Young Frankenstein or Frankenstein. It's worth picking those up for these great, great films.
Yeah, well, the guy's a genius. Mel Brooks is just an absolute genius. So Jeffrey Kleiman. Jeffrey Feldman is the guy who does Frame Shop is Open. We have two Jeffreys here. Jeffrey Kleiman, editor of DVD Talk, an online magazine, www.dvdtalk.com. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Take care. Have a good one.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't bury your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just bury your head in the sand. Politics and religious superstition go hand in hand.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 25 minutes before the hour. Broadly speaking, this hour, Republicans, please take back your party. I'm sorry. Things have just gone so wrong. And it's not just George W. Bush. It is this entire establishment. The Republican Party has in many ways, a noble past. For example, let's listen to another Republican president. Another Republican president. Teddy Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, a recording made personally by Thomas Edison.
In the last 20 years, an increasing percentage of our people have come to depend on industry for their livelihood.
You're talking about how more and more of our people have come to depend on industry for their livelihood, and we have to be concerned about the working conditions of these people.
As a people, we cannot afford to let any group of citizens or any individual citizen live or labor under conditions which are injurious to the commonwealth.
Yeah, we can't have them working, laboring under conditions which are injurious to the commonwealth. When was the last time you heard a Republican talking about the commonwealth?
Industry, therefore, must submit to such public regulation as will make it a means of life and health, not of death or inefficiency.
What? Industry must submit to regulation that will make it a means of health and life rather than death?
We must protect the crushable elements at the base of our present industrial structure. We stand for a living wage.
We stand for a living wage? This was a Republican president? 100 years ago? This is Teddy Roosevelt, a recording made by Thomas Edison. 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt. We stand for a living wage. President Roosevelt, what does a living wage mean?
Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
Okay, enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough to make morality possible. You don't have to steal to live.
Provide for education and recreation.
Provide for education. Put your kids through school and take a vacation.
Care for immature members of the family.
To care for the children, pay for their health care and their insurance.
Maintain the family during periods of sickness.
You know, maintain the family during periods of sickness. This is sounding like national health care or something here.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to have a retirement. This is a living wage. This from a Republican president.
Hours of excessive if they fail to afford the worker sufficient time to recuperate and return to his work thoroughly refreshed.
Hours are excessive if a person can't recuperate and return to work refreshed. Wait a minute. I thought the Republicans didn't want there to be maximum hour laws or minimum wage laws or living wage laws. No, I'm sorry. This is a Republican president.
Told the seven-day working week is abnormal. Told that one day of rest in seven should be provided by law.
We hold that a seven-day work week is abnormal and that one day of rest per week should be provided by law. That was a radical idea when Teddy Roosevelt said it. A Republican president. Republicans, please take back your party. Tom in Minneapolis, 1-866-440-8466. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, couple things. First of all, most Americans under 40 don't even know the difference between the Democratic Roosevelt and the Republican one.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear... Well,
yeah, this is Teddy Roosevelt. He was president from, what, 1899 to or whenever McKinley died until 1906, as I recall.
Right.
If I'm doing my math right.
I'm wondering if you... Because I got a book here I'm looking at. It's called My Fellow Americans. It has all these CDs of all these speeches. Is that the one you got that from?
I don't remember. I've got old audio clips on this computer that I've had for years.
Well, I'm looking here at that book, and on Theodore Roosevelt, he talks about Lincoln's quote, the famous one about labor being prior to capital.
Mm-hmm. And so therefore superior to capital, yes.
Exactly. And Teddy Roosevelt is quoting that, and he says here, a quickie quote, he says, if that remark was original with me, I should be even more strongly denounced as a communist agitator than I shall be anyhow. It is Lincoln's. I am only quoting it. That's what he said in his speech.
Quoting another Republican president.
Exactly. So what I wanted to say, two things about this Harry Taylor guy that gave that talked with Bush.
Yes.
And real quick, you had a caller.
Who may well be a Republican, by the way. Bush generally only lets Republicans into his events.
Right. But real quick before that, you had a caller talk about the middle class chunk that earns between $80,000 and $150,000, and they're split. And, you know, a lot of these people in that class are small business owners, and Democrats have to learn to talk about small business because that's who the Democrats represent, and quit assuming that the party of business is the Republicans, because they're not. The Republicans are big business.
Yeah.
And the Democrats.
And this is something, by the way, Tom, that your parents and grandparents and mine knew very well. I mean,
it's
frankly, I think that Eisenhower tried to bring the Republican Party back from that brink, just like Teddy Roosevelt tried to bring the Republican Party back from that brink. But tragically, the Republican Party is now back where it was under Ulysses S. Grant, under McKinley, under Hoover, under Harding, Coolidge. You know, the whole bunch of them, and it is not the Republican Party that Lincoln certainly envisioned when he was the first serious Republican candidate for
Party. Oh, no, Kevin Phillips says they would be rolling in their graves right now.
Yeah, Lincoln. In fact, I talked to Kevin Phillips this morning, and he was on this program a couple days ago.
Right, I heard it,
Monday.
Yeah. But on Harry Taylor, didn't that him standing up there look like, and the audience looking up at him, eerily evoke the Norman Rockwell painting of freedom of speech, the FDR posters,
wow,
and the Four Freedoms, didn't it?
Now that I think back, I remember looking at it thinking there's something very archetypal about this.
Exactly,
but
that's a better word, archetypal, yeah, right. And I'm going, wow, that reminds me of that Norman Rockwell painting. He's standing up there, the people are looking up at him, and he's giving it to him, right? And I think if there's an artist out there, they should do a rendition of Harry Taylor, you know, the Norman Rockwell style, right?
Harry Taylor speaks back to George.
That's right.
Okay, good point, Tom. Tom, yeah, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah.
Great to hear from you. John in Mount Vernon, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to to take to task so many Democrats that continue to suggest that this administration is basically stupid. And actually, a lot of the Republicans are now using it as a defense of
right.
this administration.
These guys are not stupid.
And they're not stupid. In my opinion, the vast majority of high school educated Americans, given the information we now know that this administration had prior to 9/11, would have had heightened security at the airports, would have had 24-hour a day air security on the nation's capital.
They would have hardened the cockpit doors.
They would have hardened the cockpit doors, and that would have probably prevented 9/11. What that suggests to me is this guy is criminally negligent of his Article 2, Section 2 responsibilities as commander in chief, and that negligence led directly to his breaking of his oath of office to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States of America. This guy is guilty of treason. He's guilty of not upholding the Constitution of the United States of America. He is guilty of outing our own agents and exactly the opposite of what Scotty the Liar suggests that he was doing.
Yeah.
This guy, when people say, oh, don't talk the I word, don't talk impeachment, this guy, they wrap themselves in the flag, but the fact is, They are criminals, but they are corporate criminals. Their only patriotism is to the international corporate criminal culture.
Yeah, I'm not. You're welcome, John. Thanks a lot for the comments. I'm not disagreeing with you a bit. Patricia in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to mention something in regards to Ambassador Joseph Wilson and the Niger documents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the major media has failed to report, and I don't know how many people know this, that there are many other officials that prior to his conclusions, and I'll give you an example here. In February 2002, you had commander of the U.S. Armed Forces in Europe, Marine General Carlton Fulford. He actually went to Niger, and he met with the country's president. And he concluded that there was a little chance that this uranium could be used, you know, could be diverted to Iraq and was
right.
being used for nuclear weapons.
Well, and in fact, the CIA had already concluded, as had Whitehall, the British, that this was a document that was forged by Berlusconi's intelligence service
right.
as a way of trying to suck up to the Bush administration. They even knew who forged it. They knew that it was Berlusconi.
Absolutely. They had, in this report I was reading, they mentioned U.S. Ambassador to Niger, Barbara Owens Kirkpatrick. She was also made the determination that those documents were false, and then we forgot what's his name, Mohamed El Bardet of the IAEA.
Yeah.
Apparently, his top officials who reviewed these documents took hours to determine that they were fake.
That's right, because there were names of people on there who had signed the documents, who had been dead for a decade.
Absolutely.
And you know, titles that weren't the right titles. I mean, yes, it was. It, not only was it a forgery. And a transparent one, but a badly done one. It was almost as if Berlusconi was saying, "Here, I'll give this to you, but good luck." You know, it's like you know, kind of.
And you know what's puzzling about all this, Tom, is if you remember, I think it was in October 2002 when George Tenet, he actually called Stephen Hadley and asked him to have that reference to the Niger uranium removed from the speech. I think Bush was going to give a speech in Cincinnati on October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush still used it in his speech.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that Bush lied and our soldiers have died. And
absolutely.
It's a terrible tragedy.
Thank you, Tom.
Patricia, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Thanks for listening to us at KSAC there in Sacramento, California. It's 11. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's 11 o'clock on the West Coast. It's, 2 o'clock on the East Coast. Tom Hartman here. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those lads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming,
Well, let's hope so. Leonard Cohen, a fine Canadian, telling us that democracy is coming to the USA. A beautiful song. Thanks, by the way, so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark and Dan Jacobs at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in the chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program and for supporting our sponsors, particularly our local sponsors. When you hear somebody sponsoring this program on a local radio station, on your local radio station, please contact them and, you know, thank them for that and patronize their products. Rob Call's with us. He's the editor and publisher of Op-Ed News, opednews.com, the website, as an opinion and editorial. Hey, Rob.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Well, let me turn up your microphone. Try it again.
How's that?
That's great. It's great to have you here with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Right here in the studio, in fact. You're here in town for a conference?
Yes, it's a biofeedback conference. Right. I, for years, was interested in inner revolution and helping people to become conscious and aware, to empower them to take control of their lives and to enable them to take greater self-responsibility. And I kind of got into it back in the 60s when it was the time to explore hallucinogens.
Mm-hmm.
And the Apollo program was happening. And there was outer space exploration. And I saw biofeedback as a form of inner space exploration with brain monitoring and brainwave training and consciousness exploration.
Well, and in fact, you put on the Winter Brain Conference.
Yes, I do.
Futurehealth.org. People can find out about that.
It's actually brainmeeting.com.
Brainmeeting.com now. Yeah. Okay. And I've, in fact, this year was the first year, I think, in 8 or 9 years or something like that, that I didn't speak at it.
It's, yeah.
You know, it's, unfortunately, I was not able to show up. But Op-Ed News, you talk about inner revolution. We're also seeing outer revolution, revolution perhaps not quite the right word. Well, actually, we've seen a real revolution in this country over the last 15 or 20 years, tremendous change in people's relationship to the commons, people's relationship to the social contract, people's notion of what's normal in politics. What do you, you know, you're seeing this over at Op-Ed News. What's your take on this kind of change and how this relates to the inner changes that people are experiencing?
I started Op-Ed News a couple weeks before the war started. I just got so disgusted with what was going on. I just had to do something that I could actually do.
Right.
I think that the people of this country have been losing consciousness. Thank God you're on the air. Thank God a couple years ago you wrote an article about the need for left-wing talk radio and started something happening and helped get Air America going with the business plan originally, because I really think that we're in a scary cycle. And it's.
I have a feeling that we're coming out of it. I really do. I think here's Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 made this comment.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Now, this was long before anybody was talking about Hitler or World War II or anything. He was talking about the economic conditions at the time. This was in 1936 when he was nominated for his second term in office. And he was talking basically about coming out of the Great Depression. You go back and read that speech, this rendezvous with destiny, recreating America. This was just 1 year after the passage of the Wagner Act. This was 1 year after the passage of Social Security.
It was about the same time that Sinclair Lewis wrote, "It Can't Happen Here," too, though.
That's right. That's right. Well, it was right after. And also Roosevelt knew, although the people didn't know. I mean, the people didn't know until the 40s when Smedley Butler finally published it, that there had actually been a coup attempt by right-wingers against Roosevelt, or that they were organizing one, that they were trying to organize one. They were trying to get the Smedley Butler, this Marine general, in on this thing. And it seems to me that we've kind of come full circle.
I think that the internet and the emergence of left-wing talk radio has made a huge difference, and I think it will continue to do so. The new developments in community kinds of websites, MySpace is for mostly people under 30. My kids, 25 and 22, turned me onto it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more of that kind of thing happening. The blogosphere, those are all going to change things, and those are starting to help to take things back and erode where the right wing has taken things.
You're at opednews.com. You're making it more interactive?
Yes, yes. I keep studying MySpace and Craigslist. And
are you finding people interacting with the site, people wanting to interact with this? I mean, we've got a message board over at tomhartman.com, and, I mean, you know, 100,000 messages a year, easy. It's incredible.
Our site has tripled in its readership in the last 8 months, and I think it's partly because of the interactivity. If you look at most of, at Alexa, most of the progressive sites, ours sees 3 to 6 times more page views per visitor than most of the other sites, and it's stickiness is the word that's used to describe when a site has people stick around longer.
Yeah, and what all this speaks to is the desire of Americans to get involved, to get active. There's a positive psychology
community. And they need community, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is becoming one of the new communities. Rob Call, opednews.com, the website. Check it out. Rob, thanks for being with us today. Great to have you here. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, this will be Monday, conservative Mark Moran claims global warming scientists are using extreme scenarios to scare the public. Yeah, right. We'll be talking to him about the selling out of the environment. And don't miss Addison Wiggin, author of Empire of Debt, The Rise of an Epic Financial Crisis. We'll find out how that crisis may unfold. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.